Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon to all. It is my great pleasure to contribute to this discussion on a topic which is extremely sensitive and high on the agenda of many governments, many within the private sector, and many from the civil society organizations. The situation is a very delicate one because at the very same time that we are witnessing the emergence of a consensus amongst international institutions about the need to guide investment in agriculture in order to ensure that it proceeds responsibly, we know that many farmers' organizations, many non-governmental organizations, are expressing their worry at what they call land grabbing. And indeed, some of them even denounce the very idea of the adoption of a code of conduct. They see this as legitimizing the view that acquisition of land is legitimate when it might deprive the poorest from their access to land and increase concentration of resources in the hands of a minority. They see, as we all do, that all too often notions such as reserve agricultural land, idle land, are manipulated out of existence as recognized by the principles for responsible agricultural investments that respect rights, livelihoods, and resources that are before us. They see that the requirement that evictions take place only for a valid public purpose, against fair compensation, following consultation of those affected, that these requirements are honored more in the breach than in the observance. These people live on the front line. They live in countries in Africa where land is considered to be state-owned and treated by governments as if it were their own. They live in Latin America, where agrarian concentration is on the rise. They live in South Asia, where many populations, as we speak, are being driven off their land to make room for large palm oil plantations, special economic zones, or reforestation projects. I believe that if it is to be responsible, agricultural investment must take these concerns seriously, and it must address them. It must be investment that benefits the poor in the south rather than leading to a transfer of resources to the rich in the north. It must be investment that truly reduces hunger and malnutrition rather than aggravating them. It is my belief that we've been moving on these issues both too slowly and too fast. Too slowly because the phenomenon is developing very rapidly and we've not yet addressed it appropriately, and too fast because we may be underestimating the concerns that are raised and the need to fit the regulation of investment into a broader development strategy. So what I'd like to do is present before you, in order to provoke the debate, 7 theses, which are detailed in my written presentation and which seek to link the micro and the macro, the project-level approach to investment, to the question of which strategy of development we should pursue, in which this investment should fit and which it should contribute to. First, public policies that aim at guiding investment should be primarily focused not on the need to boost production alone, but on the urgent need to contribute to rural development and to the increase of incomes in the rural areas. These are not two interchangeable aims. It is clear from the past that sometimes we may achieve increased levels of production. We may indeed improve productive capacities, but at the expense of more inequalities, more poverty, more exclusion in the rural areas. Second thesis, agricultural investment must fit into a broader poverty reduction strategy, including a strategy for the realization of the right to food. Investment in agriculture, vital though as it is an instrument. It is not and should not become an end in itself. The end goal of human development and the realization of the right to food should not be sacrificed for the sake of short-term objective of attracting investors. And this is the difficulty we are currently facing. I therefore am very strongly in favor of strategies as adopted in Brazil, for example, under the Fome Zero program launched in 2003, or as adopted in Mozambique with the National Food and Nutrition Security Strategy, strategies that seek to ensure that the choices which will be made in agriculture will be made in order to decrease hunger and malnutrition, contribute to food security, and investments should be evaluated in accordance with those objectives as defined in such strategies. Thesis number three, a human rights framework, I believe, is indispensable and vital to the sustainability of agricultural investment. I think that it is one thing to do things responsibly. It is quite another to do things in a way by which we are held accountable for our choices and by which we ensure that those affected by these choices will have access to remedies to protect their rights. The principles for responsible investment that respects rights, livelihoods, and resources do not refer to human rights, and I believe this is a mistake, and I believe this should be improved. Because as a result of this omission, the crucial dimension of accountability of governments and of private actors alike, this dimension is lost. But this dimension is absolutely crucial. If hunger and malnutrition are the result of social injustice and inequality, as identified 30 years ago by Amartya Sen, and if it is not simply the result of our failure to produce enough food, then protecting the legal entitlements of the poor is absolutely essential. And in my written statement, I recall which human rights principles exist that should be taken into account and that should strengthen, by a rights-based approach, any set of principles that should guide responsible investment. Thesis number four. The arrival of investment in agriculture may exacerbate the already existing competition between different types of farming, and this competition is, for the moment, deeply unequal. We have currently a debate between, to summarize and to simplify, small-scale family-type farming, which uses few external inputs and which produces for household consumption and for the local communities, when, indeed, surplus is produced, on the one side. And on the other side, large-scale, highly capitalized types of farming that develop often in the mode of plantations. Now, the competition between these two types of farming is increasing today, and these two types of farming compete for land, water, and indeed investment. But this competition is very unequal because when food is produced by large-scale mechanized plantations, which have access to credit, have access to external inputs, they can produce at very competitive prices, and they push the prices below, whether on the local or, indeed, on the regional or global markets. And small-scale family farming is a loser in this competition unless it is adequately supported. Now, there are many ways of supporting small-scale agriculture. For example, small-scale agriculture can be supported by a preferential access to support schemes. For example, lower than market rate access to credit. They can be supported, as done again in Brazil, by public procurement schemes that give them a priority. They can be supported by farmer feed schools, by extension services, which, as Secretary General Panjik Putai has referred, have been dismantled to a large extent as a result of structural adjustment policies. They can be supported by the creation of cooperatives. Now, whether these tools are sufficient to equalize the competition between small-scale farming and large producers remains to be seen, but I have no doubt that such policies urgently need to be implemented or scaled up to protect small farmers from the trends that we are witnessing. Thesis number five. In order to protect the rights of land users, titling schemes are both insufficient and may indeed be potentially damaging. It is absolutely vital to protect the rights of land users in order to make sure that they will not be evicted, expropriated, without compensation, without the search for alternatives, and without appropriate consultation of the of those affected. But simply titling property may be quite insufficient if we wish to provide an adequate protection. And the reason is that titling property, securing tenure on land, will not necessarily lead to improved production if those using the land are not supported, and will not necessarily lead to higher incomes if, for example, the macroeconomic conditions are not right, allowing them to produce at remunerative prices. Instead, security of land tenure, if it leads to the establishment of a market for land rights, may lead to land reconcentration, as we've seen, for example, in Chile in the 1980s. And so we need to be very aware that titling needs to be complemented by policies that make small-scale farming more than viable, actually remunerative and profitable for those wishing to remain in farming. And I don't think that titling alone is sufficient to protect from the risks of counter-agrarian reforms developing, increased concentration of land in violation of commitments made by the international community, for example, at the Porto Alegre International Conference on Agrarian Development and Rural Development, Agrarian Reform and Rural Development in 2006. Thesis number six, sequencing is crucial. Appropriate conditions must be created in the receiving country before investment flows in. The reason is the following. Public policies, such as support to small-scale farming, the improvement of security of tenure, the recognition of land users' rights, these policies would be more difficult to launch once the agricultural sector, which will have been transformed by the emergence of a highly capitalized sector, competitive on both the domestic and the global markets. Indeed, once such development has taken place, it will be too late often to protect those whose livelihoods may have been impacted as a result. By then, the veto points will be many and they will be difficult to overcome. For this reason, it is important to improve governance structures and the policy environment prior to the arrival of large investments in agriculture. In all likelihood, later will be too late. Thesis number seven, I believe that both receiving states and states where investments originate from have a dual responsibility to ensure that investment in agriculture proceed responsibly. Much emphasis is placed in current international discussions on the responsibility of receiving states to channel investments wisely, to protect the rights of local communities affected by the investment, and to make a transparent use of the revenues accruing for the state from the investment. But international investment is an area in which both FDI exporting and FDI receiving states have a responsibility. This is true, of course, as far as public investment is concerned, including when this takes the form of sovereign wealth funds investing in joint venture projects. But it is also true of private investment flows. Private investment funds in particular, which played an important role in the increased speculation over land over the past few months, should be appropriately monitored by their state of origin. I am currently working very closely with the OECD in the revision of the guidelines for multinational enterprises adopted in 1976 and which are currently being revisited. And I emphasize the need to guide the private sector as regards the specific question of agricultural investment in the next version of these guidelines. Ladies and gentlemen, these are the challenges that we are facing. And I believe, to repeat, that the challenge is not simply to ensure that agricultural investment on a project-level basis will develop responsibly. It is also to create the policy environment that will ensure that it will not produce the disruptive effects that all too often it has led to in the past. We cannot afford more dispossessed, greater inequality in the rural areas, and more smallholders driven off their land because farming shall have ceased to be viable for them. We cannot allow for pastoralists to have to lose access to their grazing areas and more fishers to to be cut off from their fishing grounds. We cannot tolerate more indigenous peoples being victims of the destruction of forests they depend on, or being fenced off from those forests as a result of carbon sequestration projects. And I've seen firsthand this developing currently in Southeast Asia, for example. There is no time to lose, and I'm extremely grateful for UNCTAD for providing us with the unique forum, which is this session, where to hold this vitally important discussion. Thank you very much.